三，辅助材料。
It was a Labour Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin, who opened diplomatic relations between the UK and China in January 1950. We were the first Western country to recognise the People's Republic of China, and the longevity of our relationship does give us both a strong basis from which to develop further our relations. I am delighted that Hong Kong has prospered since 1997, and that one country, two systems is proving such an effective approach. As a signatory to the Joint Declaration, we will retain interest in the well-being of the Special Administrative Region. Our economic relationship has rarely been healthier. Britain is the leading European investor in China. Many Chinese enterprises now regard Britain's flexible and open economy as an ideal launching pad into the wider European market. Our development aid program is set to double over the next 5 years and is focused on China's own priority region, the West. But the most exciting changes have been in the links between British and Chinese peoples. Chinese communities have long existed in our cities, but today, more and more British people are visiting China to see for themselves the dynamism of cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou. And the best possible news for our future links is that tens of thousands of young Chinese are pursuing their education in Britain. This year, Chinese students will be the largest group from outside the EU studying in Britain. I am now pushing through a new strategy across the UK government to ensure that we broaden our relationship and develop our mutual understanding on issues ranging from civil service reform and the environment to peacekeeping, science and law. As permanent members of the UN Security Council, Britain and China are in a pivotal position to influence developments affecting every corner of the globe. Increased cooperation on counter-terrorism, peacekeeping, conflict prevention and peace building can help to build a secure international order out of the chaos of the 11th of September. In recent years, we have seen China emerge to fulfill its destiny as an influential participant in international councils. I welcome China's international engagement as a member of the P5. I believe the participation of Chinese civilian police alongside UK personnel in UN peacekeeping operations in Bosnia and East Timor is an important signal of its commitment to international order and China's recognition that we all operate in an interdependent world. China's status as an economic powerhouse will be confirmed within the next 20 to 30 years as China becomes the world's second or third largest economy. I believe the range of its global trading and investment interests will contribute to China's increasingly influential diplomatic and political role. Over the next generation, we need to pursue a shared vision of the future. We need a system which will help us navigate the month-to-month crises of foreign policy and to capitalize on the international sense of community expressed so powerfully in the aftermath of the 11th of September. What should we be working towards in the coming 30 years? I believe there are three major challenges if we are to preserve the global order and strengthen the international rule of law. First, we need a secure global environment. This means a renewed consensus to control the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. In the 1960s and 70s, we saw the introduction of a raft of international treaties and export control regimes to control the spread of nuclear, chemical, biological, and missile technologies. Some countries show little compunction in shipping WMD technologies to any bidder. This technology is destabilizing security in the Middle East, South Asia, and potentially beyond. This trade secures immediate financial returns for the vendor, but undermines international security. There is an obvious responsibility on arms exporting nations, the UK and China included, to take all necessary steps to end it. We also have to maintain the momentum we have developed since the 11th of September in defeating terrorism. China's continued engagement in the UN's Counter-Terrorism Committee underlines its commitment to pursuing a multilateral approach on this issue. The second challenge is to create a prosperous world. In recent years, China has made an enormous contribution to the cause of global prosperity. In the past two decades, China has lifted the living standards of more people than during any other period of human history. We have a shared interest in eliminating the conditions that contribute to global insecurity and state failure. By promoting a clear environment, raising educational standards, and providing professional healthcare, we can create a more stable world. I welcome China's contribution to the international effort. Your donation of $150 million has thrown a lifeline to thousands of Afghan people. As your economic influence grows, I hope China will seize the opportunity to build up its overseas aid policy. Just as your economy is becoming the engine for future economic growth in Asia, so the Chinese aid program could become a great force for good in a continent where, for too many people, poverty is a fact of life. The final challenge is to promote the universal adoption of good governance. In country after country, across Europe, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, people and governments have adopted this principle. Countries which apply this will run with the grain of international opinion. They will be acknowledging the innate aspirations of their people. Four years ago, we set our central economic objective of high and stable levels of growth and employment. The two pillars of the government's approach are delivering macroeconomic stability to allow firms and individuals to invest for the future, and implementing microeconomic reforms to remove the barriers which prevent markets from functioning efficiently. In the last Parliament, we put in place reforms to achieve macroeconomic stability and to promote work. The UK has now achieved the highest employment of almost any OECD country and the lowest inflation in the EU. Building on this platform of stability and employment creation, we must now direct our energies to radical reform and modernisation of product, labour and capital markets, so that the UK's productivity will rise faster than that of its industrial competitors, as we close the productivity gap. On Monday, the Chancellor announced the next steps we will take to deliver this ambition. These include major reforms to the competition regime. This is at the heart of the government's strategy. Vigorous competition between firms leads to increased innovation and greater efficiency, and in turn, to increased productivity growth. So we are modernising complex monopoly powers, providing a strong legal basis for competition authorities to promote competition across the economy, giving them full independence, backed by additional resources and consulting on the introduction of criminal penalties for those involved in cartels. The Chancellor also announced a series of measures aimed at helping small and medium-sized enterprises. We will cut the capital gains tax rate on business assets, creating a regime for entrepreneur that will be more favourable to enterprise than that of the US. We are proposing the doubling of the assets limit for enterprise management incentives, so that more growing companies can attract the high-quality employees they need to realise their potential. We have also announced a new small business birth strategy, including a commitment to extend the width of the 10% corporate tax rate. SMEs are important because of their significant contribution to the UK economy. Unless this sector delivers growth, the economy as a whole will be held back. However, this focus on small business does not mean that the government has ignored the position of large business. Indeed, Large, successful enterprises are the bedrock of the world's leading economies. Globalization and the increase in internationally mobile capital have led to benefits from the growing integration of national economic systems, including greater trade in goods and services, movements of labor, and movements of capital, and the integration of the financial markets. Over the past decade, gross capital flows have increased dramatically. The UK ranks second largest in the world in terms of inward and outward direct investment, with multinational companies now playing an especially important role. There are substantial benefits in terms of higher investment growth efficiency gains and the transfer of innovations and best business practices across national boundaries. But it has to be recognised that these changes mean that problems which were formerly seen as domestic have become international ones. Business is mobile, particularly multinational business, and naturally wants to minimise costs, including tax. And tax policies, in turn, may be designed primarily to divert mobile capital. These are changes which give rise to concern that anti-competitive tax practices elsewhere may distort business decisions and prove counterproductive in the end, whilst underlining the need for tax competition between countries on terms which are fair. Tax systems and regimes must be modernised if we are to meet the wider economic challenge. So we must respond effectively to anti-competitive tax practices, ensure that our tax system is efficient, and eliminate unnecessary rigidities in a tax system that act as a barrier to business. At the same time, the UK recognises that tax systems in different countries need to respond in different ways to the challenges we face. The tax systems we have each developed are based on cultural preferences which are at the heart of our individual national policies and preferences. For example, EU member states have to fund differing levels of public services and have different preferences for one tax over another. And different tax systems also allow governments to respond to national preferences on the role, structure, and aims of taxation. We do not need to question this diversity. We do not need to harmonise to meet the challenges we face. But we do need to foster the natural dynamism within our economies. I see no contradiction between taking effective action against abuse and harmful tax competition and building a dynamic economy. The key is to preserve that natural dynamism while strengthening the effective cooperation between governments. Countries across the globe have a choice, either to turn inwards, in which case we will fail to respond effectively to anti-competitive tax practices which inhibit the development of competition, or to face the global challenge and work with partners to allow fair tax competition to flourish, allow the creation of efficient tax systems based on broad bases and low rates, and counter pressures for tax harmonisation. Secrecy, lack of transparency, and discrimination are all examples of anti-competitive practices. Lack of transparency and secrecy encourage tax evasion and avoidance, which in turn inhibits government's ability to apply their tax laws fairly and effectively to individuals and businesses alike. The result is that the respect for law is undermined, and that in turn can result in distortion of the market and economic growth and development. The UK sees transparency and exchange of information as being essential for effective competition. But exchange of information and transparency alone are not sufficient to allow fair tax competition to flourish. When tax systems discriminate between companies of the same size, carrying on the same line of business, then, by definition, we do not have a level playing field. And though in some cases an element of discrimination may be soundly based in economics to compensate for failures in the market, in most it is not. When the design of tax measures is such that commercial decisions are distorted in a discriminatory way, this will inhibit, not enhance, stable and sustainable economic growth. The UK supports action to limit discriminatory practices that are anti-competitive.